Hi there, and welcome to A Different Way of Seeing. Have you ever wondered how a disabled person lives their life? Join our host, Lois Drachen, as she chats to people about work, education, travel, sport, the arts, and leisure, and the tools and techniques they use to live their lives with the disability. And now, on with the show.
Hi there, it's Lois. If you're a person with a disability who's wanting to achieve a goal and is looking for some help to get there, then maybe I'm the person you need to talk to. Listen after the interview and find out more details of how I can help you to reach your goals and dreams. Thanks today to Hindenburg Pro for assisting us in producing the show. That's Hindenburg.com. Hindenburg, it's all about the story. Hi there, and welcome to today's episode of A Different Way of Seeing, a podcast where we talk all things disability. I'm your host, Lois Drachen, and today we are being joined from the USA by Trish Butler and Carrie Lowe. And they're going to be chatting to us about some of their travels and about a book that Carrie has just released that is outlining some of the stories of their many, many travels. Now, I've had an opportunity to read that book, and it is absolutely delightful. And I'm very glad that I had the opportunity to read it. But rather than me talk more about what I enjoyed about the book, why don't I let you then meet Carrie and Trish and learn about their stories from themselves. So Trish, Carrie, welcome to A Different Way of Seeing. It's great to have you with us. How are you doing today?
Well, I guess I probably should start. I was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis over 30 years ago. Yeah. And for the first probably 10 or 15 years, it was pretty benign. And I had, you know, pretty much full use of my legs and everything else. Then in 10 years or so, my legs became less cooperative. And I ended up having to use a scooter. And then now I use a power wheelchair. And I really haven't found that to be all that restricting, simply because Carrie and I continued to travel the whole time. And I was diagnosed with MS when I met Carrie. And Carrie and I have been together for about 30 years. And it pretty much has worked. And that's because Carrie is extremely patient, and he's learned a lot about traveling with a disabled companion.
It's one of the things that I know many people who are scooter and wheelchair users say, is that they really have issues, and I'm using that word guardedly, with the term wheelchair bound that is so common around the world today, simply because a wheelchair or a scooter is such a device of liberation. So I'm glad to hear that it, while it's probably changed the way that you travel, that it hasn't restricted your travels too significantly.
And if we could just get that phrase changed to wheelchair user.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, bound.
I agree with you, absolutely. Thank you, Trish. So yeah. Carrie, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, Trish and I both were professional people when we met, and we both had a history of doing a lot of traveling, and that motivated us to keep traveling together. I was working as a lawyer. Trish had a consulting business, so we both were very active people. I was really determined from the start, as was Trish, to keep leading as normal a life as possible, notwithstanding her physical limitations that developed over time, mild at first, but then worsening as the years went by. So it's been a learning process and an adventure, but over the 25 years that we've been together, we've developed a lot of what I call coping mechanisms and methods to deal progressively better with those restrictions that Trisha's MS has imposed. So we'll talk more about specific instances and examples, but I think just as an introductory comment, I'd say we've aspired to continue to lead as normal lives as possible, which is important for anyone with a disability of any sort, and travel, which can be the most challenging aspect of life for people with disabilities because you're out of your normal environment. We've been adamant about trying to maintain as good a travel regimen as we could.
And are many of the insights and the techniques that you've developed, you've now packaged into a book called On Two Legs and Three Wheels. Tell us about the book. What prompted you to decide to sit down and write it?
Sure. I've been a writer for some time. I had written a previous book that was a political memoir, and I've written scores of essays published in different publications. But this book was really more a labor of love. It started out as some freestanding stories about Trisha's and my travels, but then rapidly turned into a full book. And the motivation behind it was twofold. One, I just like telling good stories, but I also, in this instance, wanted to serve as an inspiration for people who, like us, had to deal with any sort of significant disability that would interfere with their traveling, especially if it was something that was already an important part of their life. And I wanted to hold us out as an example to other people with disabilities and their partners and companions as to how feasible it is to keep traveling, to keep experiencing the world and broadening your horizons and interacting with other people and places. And so that's what I'm hoping is and will be the primary effect of the book.
Why is travel so important to both of you?
Let's see. Carrie, why don't you start?
No, please, you go ahead.
Is this one of those classic questions with a couple goes, you know, just give me a bit of time to think.
Well, I think, as I said, the reason it's important to me is I've traveled my whole life, and I think it's important to travel. There are so many people in the United States who have never even been out of their city, practically. And we met so many people in our travels who had never left their little village. I mean, like, we met people in England so frequently, really delightful people. And we asked them about, you know, a famous, you know, cultural site, like a few miles away from their village. And this woman said, oh, no, I've never been there. We said, well, is there any place you might want to suggest that we should see? Well, no, I've never left my village ever. And she was like an elderly woman. So, you know, so you run into that. But then you frequently run into people who are just delighted to help you see something or go somewhere. Or they'll be aware of well, you probably will have a hard time at something, you know, because there's only stairs or whatever. So, and as a result of that, I mean, we just haven't found my disability to interfere with our ability to enjoy where we are.
I think much like you, Trish, you know, when I was about 5 or 6 years old, I said to my parents that when I grew up, I wanted to go everywhere in the world and meet everyone in the world. And despite becoming blind, that hasn't changed. Uh-huh. I do now am old enough to realize that I might be unrealistic in expecting to do that, but it's not going to stop me from trying.
Right. Right, right.
Gary,
right.
What about you? What does travel mean to you?
Yeah, it's broadening your horizons, experiencing more of the world and of different kinds of people and places. You know, I grew up in Central and Eastern Europe before moving to the United States, and so I was already accustomed to meeting and dealing with people from different cultures. So that was an important thing to me my whole life, because as we were saying earlier, both Trish and I came from families that traveled a lot and exposed us to different people and places from the earliest age. So travel is just a key part of the whole panorama of experiences that I like to have in my life. I can't think of any place that we've gone that I was sorry we went to or that I wish we hadn't gone to, because even the ones where we had the greatest difficulty, we still had good experiences of other kinds. And I think that's important for people who have any sort of restrictions to remember that there will be obstacles, there will be problems, and sometimes they'll be insurmountable, but you just can't let those get in the way of the otherwise enjoyment of the experience of being in a new and interesting place or interacting with different kinds of people. That's the message that I like to give to people when they say, what's so important about traveling? There's even studies that show how important it is for people to get out of their homes and out of their familiar surroundings and have different experiences. It's good for their mental health, and it actually adds to longevity. So traveling is a real good, important part of all that.
I want to look a little more deeply then at some of the types of challenges that you experience traveling as a result of Trisha's MS, because I do understand some of the challenges that people experience just around the world, being wheelchair users and with mobility issues. What would you say are some of the most common or some of the most difficult challenges to overcome that you've experienced?
Trish, why don't you start on that?
Well, one thing that I think anybody who's restricted to, you know, being in a chair of some type is you're like below 3 feet tall. Yeah. And what I found very frustrating is a lot of people who are standing, they tend to overlook you, or because you're the height of a 10-year-old, they treat you like a child. And so I've had to be, I'm not rude. I'm always smiling and, you know, say, excuse me, you know, I'm down here. And so that's one thing where you just have to be a little more assertive, but always with a smile. Just don't be ticked off at a place or somebody, because they don't mean to be rude or whatever. But you kind of have to be able to go with the flow. Yeah, I guess that's the main thing.
That ability to be flexible, I think, is really important.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I think to add to that, the challenges that come up most for me is the physical obstacles that we run into, and because I have to try to anticipate those and figure out ways to get around them, whether it's stairs or steep slopes or other structural or topographical impediments that make it difficult for Trisha's scooter or wheelchair to negotiate a particular place. Sometimes we can find alternative ways of getting somewhere. Sometimes we have to rely on other people to help us. And we've had extraordinary experiences of people really, without even being asked, springing to our assistance. I talk in my book about a couple of situations. For example, I trying to get on a bus in Paris where the wheelchair ramp wouldn't deploy, and a group of fairly large men on the bus got off, lifted up Trish on her scooter, and carried her onto the bus, and then helped her off again the same way when at our destination. I had a similar experience
And
with
we didn't ask for their assistance.
Yeah, they just sprung to help. At a restaurant in Ljubljana, Slovenia, a restaurant that had been highly recommended to us turned out to have a few steps going up into it. And as we started to turn around to leave, one of the staff came out and asked if we needed help. And we pointed the stairs and said, oh, he says, stairs are no problem. Brings out a group of his colleagues, and they did the same thing, lifted up Trish on her scooter, carried her up the steps into the restaurant, and then later back out. Things like that happen to us quite often, and it's always a very affirming experience because it tells you that not only can you travel independently, but you when you run into problems, there are usually people who can help you deal with them. So and it can even be more trivial things like a maitre d' in a restaurant being willing to move tables or other customers to help you get to your table when if there's only a narrow space too narrow for a wheelchair to get through, or things like that that people who aren't disabled and don't have to think about these things, but we do, and we're happy that that people are so often willing to help us.
What about those few occasions where you find that people aren't willing to help? How do you manage that?
I'll give you a good example. A few years ago, we took a winter trip to Sequoia National Park in California, which is in the Sierra Nevada mountains. And this was right during the Christmas New Year's break. And we had been there before, but in the summertime, and we're a little unprepared for the conditions because what we found was that to get from our hotel room, say, to the lodge where the dining room was, required traveling pathways that were paved, but that were also icy, and they weren't very well cleared. So the Trisha's scooter had great difficulty getting traction on them. So even though I could push her, she was sliding all over the place. There were transportation trams within the park to get from place to place, but the wheelchair lifts in them didn't always work, so we could be left standing in icy cold outdoors waiting for another tram that hopefully would have a working lift. In one instance, the pathway going from the parking lot up to the hotel building was blocked by somebody who had parked their car there. And there was just
Oh,
no other path for us to get up there. And I wound up having to push Trish up a steep slope in snow to get onto this path. So this is just an example of the kinds of impediments that you don't expect, especially because we had been to another national park, Yosemite, in the winter, same time of year, where we ran into none of those problems. And so we didn't expect to have those at Sequoia, and yet they came up. But we dealt with them all. You know, I pushed the scooter. I just helped Trish negotiate these obstacles, and we made it work, even though it was a lot more trouble than we had anticipated.
But how do they make you feel experiencing challenges like that?
A little disappointed at people who could have made things easier for us, but also kind of proud of ourselves for dealing with them, you know, and feeling like, well, if we could deal with this. And let me give you one other example, because this is an even better one. When we were in Paris, the charger for Trisha's scooter burned out. There we are, 6,000 miles from home, unable to recharge the scooter, and the battery is dying. What are we going to do? We were just on our second day of a vacation trip with almost 2 weeks ahead of us, first in Paris and then in Provence. So there was no replacement charger available there. We had to have one shipped to us from San Diego, which took several days and didn't reach us until we were in Avignon several days later. So what could we do? Well, Trish stayed on her scooter, of course, and I literally pushed her around Paris for 3 days. but what else could we do? And, you know, so again, it was a good example of you have a unexpected, awful situation, but you deal with it as best you can. You roll with it and just somehow make it work for you, even though it's something you never expected. And, you know, but you learn from it. And now we carry an extra charger with us when we travel, so in case we ever run into a similar problem.
You know, to me, the stories that you're sharing speak a lot about resilience, about determination, about an active choice that the two of you have made to say, this is where we are. This is what we want to do. And we'll figure it out if there are problems. And that problem-solving ability is something that I think plays into the lives of many people living with and close to the area of disability. And, you know, travel is no different from other parts of life, except it has these extra perks of new experiences, new cultures, new foods, new people, new places. So, yeah, that speaks very highly to that.
And take a good dictionary with you if you're somewhere that you don't speak the language. So find a good portable dictionary you can put in your pocket or your purse. And, you know, it's really, everybody loves it. They love it when they see you're trying to speak their language. Yeah. And they'll try to, you know, to the extent they can, they'll try to help. And English has become the international language. You'll find so many people come close to speaking English frequently better than we do.
That's true. But I also understand what you're saying there, Trish, about how people appreciate the attempts to acknowledge and be their language. And it's something that I find is something that I've benefited from in many different countries, in Greece, in France, and just being able to speak a few words just to say good morning. Hello and thank you. It's very much a reality, and it's I think it's only respectful.
Funny thing is that we've experienced that, as you say, people appreciate you making the effort to speak their language. Trish is fluent in French.
Yeah.
I still speak passable German. And yet, when we speak to people in their language, they almost invariably respond in English. it's as if they don't, I don't know if they're practicing their English or if they just feel that it would be easier for us if they speak to us in English, but it almost always happens that way.
Yeah,
I agree. I've had the same experience, particularly in France, and maybe, I don't know, but trying is still important, and continuing and speaking as much as you can. Mm-hmm. I think it's important to try.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I'd like to move about what advice you would offer as people traveling as much as you have in different circumstances. What kind of advice would you offer to the hospitality and tourism providers that you engage with about how to make their venues more inclusive?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, we know from our experience what a lot of the obstacles are that exist right now. And some of them are things that are they're hard to deal with. For example, when we fly, the airlines make us wait until everyone else has deplaned. Then they can bring a scooter or wheelchair to the airplane door. And it's a nuisance, especially if we're trying to catch a connecting flight. Yeah. But we understand that it's also not fair to make 200 other people wait while we get off first. And typically, they don't have the scooter or wheelchair waiting for us yet anyway. It has to be unloaded and brought around. So that's one of those things that we wish there was a way to deal with it, but we're not sure what it might be. On the other hand, there are lots of things that, say, hotels could do. Have, first of all, more accessible rooms.
Mm-hmm.
Make those rooms that they advertise as accessible, really accessible, which they aren't always. They are nominally, but they may still have an entrance to the bathroom that's very narrow or at an odd angle or something. They may not have a roll-in shower. There are things that they could do easily mm-hmm. to make rooms more accessible. There might be pathways that a fully able person could negotiate because there are stairs, but what's someone in a wheelchair to do to get, say, to the swimming pool if there are stairs in the way, or even to the dining room? Or what if there's, we've discovered hotels that say they have accessible rooms, but they're on an upper floor and there's no elevator. So what is it about that room that's accessible? There's a lot of just misinformation out there, and especially among like hotel reservation agents who often really don't know the facts and will tell you things that they kind of think are true as if they're a fact, and you can't rely on that. So we've learned that, and so we always call hotels and talk to somebody more in authority directly and ask them to say, we see the room on your website, but tell us more about this or that feature of it.
Mm-hmm.
Other transportation modes are similar problems where that are more fixable than the airlines. In Paris, the metro subway system only has elevators at certain stations. Well, you have to know in advance which ones. Otherwise, you could be stuck on a train and not able to get off where you want to get off. Well, they could add some elevators. I suspect that wouldn't be that difficult a thing to do. Trains, Similarly, especially in older on older train lines, the platforms often don't have a level entry onto the trains, so you rely on lifts to get you on and off. But it's a big deal to make arrangements to get someone to operate one of those lifts for you. And there's a story in the book about a almost catastrophic train trip that was from Berlin to Vienna, where at every step of the way, we ran into problems with people not either not having made the necessary arrangements, or somehow the right people didn't get the messages or whatever. There just needs to be better systems in place for all of these types of hospitality industry accommodations to deal with the needs of people like us, so that we don't have to kind of make our way through this maze on our own. It should be easier, and it can be with just a little extra effort on their part. You know, Trish, what, you want to add anything to that?
Well, I would say that you need to be your own advocate.
Yeah.
Don't assume that the travel agent took care of something or other. So I would say always call the hotel that you're going to. Always. And you can ask them, how do I get from the lobby to my room? How do I get from my room to the dining place? How do I get from my room to the pool? Because they won't have thought about it.
Yeah.
You say, well, I can't do stairs. I'm on wheels. I need to go places where I can roll to. And they just haven't thought of it usually. And they go, oh, well, let me see. And they have to actually think about it. So I just think it's important to be, as I said, be your own advocate. Don't be afraid to ask. Ask nicely. Don't be rude or upset or say, how could you possibly, just, you know, do it.
Well, let me give you one other example, because when I talked about hotels having more accessible rooms, the other aspect of that is that they often put the accessible rooms in the least desirable places hotels.
Yeah.
Even in really fine establishments, you find that. And what we've had to do on occasion is we get there, we find, for example, at the Ahwahnee Lodge in Yosemite National Park, famous lodging place, the accessible room they gave
and
us
it's
was
high end. I mean, it's high end.
Yeah, and the hotel gave us a room that was right under the eaves of the hotel with no view at all.
Oh.
Here we are in this beautiful place, and you want to have a view. So what do? We called the manager and said, look, here's the problem. We would rather have a non-accessible room with a nice view. And he said, okay, and gave us a room with a wonderful view of Yosemite Falls. And we made do with the room not having the accessible features, but it was still good enough.
Yes.
And we were glad we made the change. But we did that by being advocates for ourselves and not just settling for what they gave us, and rather firmly but politely asking to fix it.
For example, Carrie, at the Ahwahnee, we went down to the front desk and we spoke to a guy at the desk, and I spoke to him and made the same point. And I said, you know, we've been looking forward to coming here, you know, all year and blah, blah, blah. And now we're stuck. And so he was great. He goes, I will get you to a nice place. So as an example, again, of being personable and polite, and people want to help. People want to help you have what you need.
What about when
they just often don't think about it?
Yeah. But what about when people don't want to help? The training, the exposure that people have to disability is perhaps not as good as it should be. Have you encountered any problems along that line?
Yeah, the one that comes to mind is we go to a lot of Caribbean islands and have generally had good experiences. But on the island of Curaçao in the southern end of the Caribbean, we found very poor accessibility, especially along the streets where there were no corner ramps or very few curb cuts. And we wound up having to travel right in the street most of the time with very busy traffic. And people were so rude and so oblivious to our situation, honking their horns at us, like, get out of our way. Why are you in the street? And it was really kind of offensive. But we realized that we were the only people we saw there on a scooter or wheelchair. It was like you could see why people with mobility disabilities wouldn't go out in the street because it was so difficult. And except right around the waterfront where the cruise ships unloaded, there the accommodation was much better because so many cruise ship passengers are on wheelchairs or scooters, and they know they need to accommodate them. But that was it. Now, times change, and I noticed recently that on Curaçao, there now is even a company that rents mobility scooters and wheelchairs, and that advocates for disabled people. So they've gotten the message apparently over time that they need to do better. But what bothered us most was the negative reaction from the drivers going by us and treating us so rudely.
I can understand that. Even just engaging with rideshare services, there are some people who just are unwilling to assist me because I travel with a guide dog. So, and that makes a huge impact on the ease of travel and, the training that people experience or the exposure that people have is a huge part of that. And there are some countries that I know of where exposure is maybe not as good as it might be. So it's good to know that things can change and that they can improve. So, Carrie, going back to your book, one of the other topics that you address is that of travel for people from the aging community. Now, I know that often in the hospitality industry, we hear that people who really are able to engage with travel are people who are perhaps a little bit older, but that also brings across certain consequences, certain implications. Why was this a topic that you decided to address in the book? And yeah, tell us about your thoughts around this.
Sure. Well, both Trish and I, are in our 70s, so we are aging. So completely apart from Trish's disability, we're conscious of the restrictions that simply aging will begin to impose on most people. Thankfully, I'm still in pretty good health, and other than her MS, Trish is also in reasonably good health. But we see a lot of people, people we know at home, who are our age or older, who have many more other health issues. And these manifest themselves through things like just being very slow walkers, or being reliant on a cane or walker simply because their legs don't work as well anymore with age. People whose eyesight is fading, people who are just physically weaker and need assistance in, say, getting up from a chair or getting onto a bus or into a car. And these are all conditions that are not so different from those faced by somebody with mobility issues. So most of the things that Trish and I deal with are quite similar to the ones that somebody who's just simply aging will have to deal with. So the same, or largely the same lessons apply, that you know, it's important if you are having those issues and you want to keep traveling, again, anticipate the kinds of issues, obstacles you're going to have. It's best to have a traveling companion, whether it's a spouse or a friend, somebody that's maybe a little more physically able to help you when you do run into these problems, maybe to give you that little boost to get onto a bus or to help pull you up from a chair, or just to point out little obstacles along the way if your eyesight is fading. Just, you know, to do these simple, helpful tasks that that can make traveling less dangerous and more enjoyable. So, as I say, I think that the lessons that we've learned are largely applicable to an aging population too. And the inspiration that the book tries to give to disabled people is completely equally applicable to people who are aging and have those same concerns about their ability to keep traveling. And lastly, it's important for people who are aging to remember that with travel and with their exposure to other people and places, that will keep their mental acuity better. It will improve their mental health overall. And as I mentioned before, it even has been shown to increase longevity. So for all those reasons, older people should have lots of motivation to keep traveling for as long as they're physically and mentally able.
I think there's one other side that you haven't mentioned, but is very obvious to me from what you're saying. And that is that it is in the interests of the hospitality industry, of the service providers, to make their services more inclusive, because it means that they will be still able to serve a larger population. And by making their services more inclusive, more people will be able to go there.
No, you're absolutely right. And I mentioned in the foreword to my book that at least in the United States, and this is probably roughly the same in most countries, the many millions of people who have some form of physical disability, as well as the much larger number of people who are simply aging. And this is a huge audience, a huge a group of people who are potential customers for the hospitality industry, and many or most of whom probably have been travelers at some points in their life, maybe continually. And it's so important for the industry to make it possible for these people to keep traveling, or even to induce them to travel, even if they weren't before. So, yeah, you make an excellent point that it's even out of sheer self-interest, it would behoove the industry to be more attentive to the needs of aging and disabled potential travelers.
I wish I could remember the figures, but a few years ago, I saw a report of the actual value in US dollars of the accessible travel market or the inclusive travel market. Mm-hmm. And it was a truly staggering figure. I don't remember whether it was just billions or bigger than that, but I remember sitting there thinking, how can people not see the value of making their services inclusive?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think to some extent it's inertia. It requires learning new things and making new efforts that weren't being pursued before. in some cases, it requires a lot of effort because depending on where you are in the world, buildings may be much older and harder to retrofit. That's something we've encountered in many places, you know, much older cities or rural villages or whatever. At the same time, we've also seen how even those places, when they make an effort, can improve conditions so much more than they probably thought they could. And certainly it makes a big difference to the traveling public that that benefits from those changes. So I guess my message to the industry would be, it's not as hard as you think it is, and it's really worth the effort because it pays off for you and for your clientele.
Yeah. Talking about older, more established cities, Trish, how do you find traveling through areas that are cobbled? Is it as hard for you as other wheelchair users claim?
I hate it. I absolutely hate it.
It's quite a physical workout, isn't it?
It is. And you bounce. I mean, the bouncing that, you know, I can deal with kind of the maneuvering, but bouncing around is just miserable. So we'll do whatever we can to find an edge or something that's not cobbled, but sometimes it's unavoidable and you can do it, but it's just uncomfortable.
Yes. And it can be physically demanding on you as well.
Right. I mean, how do you maneuver with a cobblestone?
I dislike them. I usually lift my white cane, hold onto my husband's arm and just put my head down and go for it. There really sometimes is no way other than through it.
Right, exactly.
I want to ask each of you, I know, Carrie, you've said there's no place that you've been to that you wouldn't, that you have not enjoyed in some way. But what are some of your favorite places that you've traveled to? Two from each of you.
I'm sorry, I didn't quite understand your question.
Your favorite
travel places?
Well, I think, and I'll be interested to see if Trish agrees with me on this. I think the favorite trip for me was Alaska. We took a 2-week trip that began as just a plan to take a cruise from Anchorage or rather Seward down the coast of Alaska and British Columbia to Vancouver, and see scenery, wildlife, and you know, I have glaciers and so on. Then we discovered that the cruise line offered an inland tour as well. And that excited us. So we signed up for that. And what that consisted of was riding a train first from Anchorage north to Denali National Park, overnighting there and then taking the train on to Fairbanks, which is right in the middle of the state. But that's where the train line ends. There we got on a bus and rode for 2 days on a dirt highway from there all the way to the north coast on the Arctic Ocean, crossing the Arctic Circle, just had a spectacular experience of seeing scenery and wildlife that we never could have experienced anywhere else, going over a high mountain pass, seeing huge herds of caribou, grizzly bear, wolves, musk oxen, all kinds of animals that one would never see where we live. What topped it off, I'll let Trish tell you what happened at the hotel we stayed at. Not exactly a hotel, more a cluster of mobile homes sitting on the permafrost.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, there was a really nice finale to our visit there. But overall, I think, one of the one of our, maybe our best trip, not only because of what we saw and did, but how accessible things turned out to be, to our pleasant surprise. And how, to the extent that things were a little inaccessible, we managed to deal with them. So that was all around a great trip. Patricia, go ahead and add what you would like.
Yeah, what are you thinking about the Denali trip?
Yeah. Well, what I thought you might want to add is what happened at the hotel up at Dead Horse when what they gave you.
Well, they gave us a ridiculous room that we couldn't get to. Right. And
yeah, the accommodations were very Spartan. But what I was referring to was when we were about to leave the hotel at the end of our stay, you remember the manager took us into his office along with a few other people, and they gave Trish a certificate that read.
They gave me a certificate. And I was the first scooter to the Arctic Ocean.
That is fantastic. Congratulations.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, nice to have it recognized.
It was funny. But yeah. They, again, it's an example of people are delighted to meet someone who's like a real person, you know, who's interested in visiting their part of the world and making an effort, and they'll make an effort to help you.
And for sure.
In all the places in the world where people have, you know, a really bad taste in their mouth about Paris, we found Paris to be fabulous. A great place to visit.
Us as well. Yeah, I would agree with that. And Trish, what kind of places are your favorite destinations? What is your ideal trip?
It's hard to pick, isn't it?
Yeah. I would probably say Paris.
Yeah?
I'd go back to Paris anytime. And it's different every time you go. And so that's pretty fun. And I find that the Parisians are much better than they used to be.
Okay. And
they like having Americans, actually. And they didn't used to. I went to my junior year in college at the University of Bordeaux. And that was in ancient history. And they, Americans, were like, what? You know, we haven't seen you since 1945 or whatever.
Yeah.
And they just couldn't handle, they just couldn't deal. And they tried, you know, in their limited way. But as the decades have gone on, they're much more international. They're much more cosmopolitan, they're much more internationally oriented and welcoming to people from around the world.
Yeah.
And people who they don't expect to speak French.
Yeah.
So, you know, places that you might be worried about going to these days in, you know, 2025, you have to go really, really, really far off the beaten path for someone. And again, what I've found is with elderly people, same thing. I mean, they want to help you enjoy being there. And so, you know, I think just be open. Just be open, a little bit of smile on your face, and you say, excuse me, I can't really get up those stairs. Is there a better way to get into your restaurant? And that kind of thing.
I think, you know, I'm consistently hearing the insight that it is the people that can make the difference about setting the tone of an experience or a place that you visit or a venue or something like that. And that's a really lovely kind of sentiment to know how important it is, because you know, people connecting with people is really, it's what we're doing now. You know, I'm talking to you where you are, and you're talking to me all the way in Cape Town in South Africa. So, and
yeah, let me give you an example of how the extent to which people are willing to go to help. I mentioned before that we like to go to Caribbean islands, partly because I scuba dive and so I like to go to those kind of destinations. We were on the island of Grand Cayman, and Trish had scuba dived once before with a guide on another trip. But by the time we were on Grand Cayman, she was already a little weaker. But the scuba people there that I was diving with, they said there's a place that they could take her to that she would remember the rest of her life. And they got her onto a boat with a lot of help, then helped her down a ladder, moving her legs one step at a time, into the water, got her scuba equipment on her, dropped down to 20 or 30 feet onto a sand bottom that was known as a place where stingrays congregate.
Oh, wow.
And we sat there on the bottom with the 10 other people, and the stingrays started to come around and swarm around us. And they particularly swarmed around Trish. And it was a really unique experience. I had done something similar once in Tahiti, but it's something that doesn't happen in very many places. And it was just a unique experience for her and for me to observe this happening for her. And it only was possible because the scuba diving staff there was willing to go really way beyond what they would normally do for anybody, because they really wanted her to have this this great experience. And it just made the trip. Everything else there was interesting and fun. Mm-hmm. That was the high point by any standard of that trip, and something that we'll both remember forever.
It sounds like an amazing experience. Wow.
Well, and also the guide, the dive master, said that they'd seen that before, mm-hmm. that the stingrays, they almost gravitate to someone who's less abled or whatever. And it could be an elderly person or like I was. They just seem to know that. And they're very gentle about it. I mean, they come up to you and they would like brush up against me, and their bellies are like velvet. Oh. And you're like looking at this barb at the end of their tail, you know. it was not a problem. It was great.
Oh, that sounds extraordinary. How wonderful for you.
Mm-hmm.
So, Harry, if people would like to get hold of a copy of your book, On Two Legs and Three Wheels, how can they get hold of it?
Yes, the book is available on Amazon. It has a page there. It's also available directly from the publisher called Black Rose. And any bookstore can order it. You may find it on the shelf in some, but these days, any bookstore can order books and have them in hardly any time at all. So it's widely available. Hopefully people who have watched and listened to this podcast will be motivated to check it out. We're very excited about doing these kind of interviews and discussions, and want to share our experience with a much wider audience. So we appreciate the opportunity to talk with you about it. If I may, I'd like to add just one thing that we didn't cover in our discussion. And that is that when we tell people about our travels, we often have people say, well, they say to me, don't you feel a little restricted by having to just help Trish all the time? Is it really a vacation trip for you? And I say, you know, most of the things that I do with her, I want to do anyway. Mm-hmm. But the other aspect of it is that there are lots of things that I can do on my own, So I mentioned before that scuba diving is something I enjoy. Well, when we go to a Caribbean island or Hawaii or wherever, I may go off diving in the morning, but while I'm gone, if Trish wants to, she can sleep late, she can have a leisurely breakfast, she can read. There's no shortage of things for her to do on her own.
You can go to the pool and
Yeah, and then I'll be back by midday, and then we can go spend the afternoon doing something together. Smaller things, if you're walking about a city and you would like to get up to some viewpoint, well, maybe there's stairs to get up there and Trish can't go there. Fine, she can go into a shop or a bookstore, do something else for a little while I go up and to this viewpoint and then take pictures, which I can share with her. Mm-hmm. So it's a matter of being flexible on both of our parts. And I think that's something that frankly pertains to any couples that travel together. You don't have to do everything together. You should plan on finding activities and things to do that that you can do separately that add to both of your enjoyments of your travel.
And I find it's the same traveling with my husband. There are some things that he does that I'm not all that interested in doing. And we arrange things in such a way that he takes part in those activities when I get a little bit tired and I just need to rest. Or if there's something, you know, that I can do that he's not as interested in, we find a way to do that. So,
right.
And it is. It is the same for any couple. It should be the way people travel. There's no concept of being tied to another person 24 hours a day unless that is how that particular couple sees it, in which case I would have to question the authenticity of their relationship, I suspect, because clearly you don't and clearly we don't as a couple. So yeah, thank you so much for sharing all that you have. I loved reading the book. I will definitely endorse it. And I think it's an absolutely delightful read. Lovely to hear about the variety of your travels, some of the experiences, some of the countries, some that I've been to and some that I haven't, both of which I found interesting. But I want to just ask one final question, and that's this. What is the one final message that you would like to leave with our audience tonight?
Trish?
Well, I think even if you're not an extrovert, but you should kind of be proud of yourself in your adventure. And people around you may not expect you to, particularly if you're old, you know, older. Older than Carrie. But people usually appreciate seeing someone like you or us, out and about and enjoying their country or their location. And even like in airports and stuff, they want to assist you or accommodate you. Don't be afraid to ask for assistance.
Well said,
Terry.
Yeah, I think the even larger message is be confident in your ability to get out there and continue traveling, regardless of your age and your disability. Recognize that there may be things you simply can't do. Maybe you can't bicycle through Provence or something. You can't climb Mount Everest, but you can do a lot of things. You can lead a very full, satisfying travel life and experience extraordinary people and places. And it just requires, as I say, self-confidence, but also flexibility, a willingness to to go with things that change or get in the way, a willingness to make the effort to be an advocate for yourself and your needs mm-hmm. when you're in a different environment away from home. And as Trish says, to not be afraid to ask for help if it isn't already forthcoming. We found all of those things to be essential attributes for our travel experience. And again, conveying that was has been a really major aspect of why I wrote this book of On Two Legs and Three Wheels, and why I hope that people will read it and be inspired by it.
Well, thank you both. And on that note, I think that's a great way to call the conversation to a close. Carrie Lowe, Trish Butler, thank you so much for joining us on A Different Way of Seeing. Thank you for sharing some of your insights, and thank you for sharing the book with me and allowing me to learn a little bit more about your lives and your travels.
Great. Well, thank you, Lois. Same here. Thank you.
Thank you for having us. Very enjoyable.
Hi, it's Lois again. I'm not certain if you know, but I am a coach who works specifically with people with disabilities. If you have a disability and are wanting to achieve your goals, or maybe think through some of the challenges that you're facing in your professional or personal life, or want to take up a new opportunity, a new adventure, but just don't seem to be able to get to doing it, let's explore how I can help you. Hop onto the Contact Me form on my website, www.loisstrachan.com. That's Loisstrachan, LOISSTRACHAN.com. And sign up for a 30-minute discovery call so we can chat to see if I am the right person to help you to achieve your goals. Contact me now for that free 30-minute discovery call on loisstrachan.com. I'd love to have the opportunity of helping you to achieve your goals.
Thank you for listening to A Different Way of Seeing. We would love to connect with you. So find Lois at loisstrachan.com or Facebook Lois Strachan Speaker. This podcast was edited by Craig Strachan using Hindenburg Pro. Hindenburg, it's all about the story. The credits are done at Naledi Media. Naledi Media, all your vocal needs under one roof. Read by Charlie Jassy. That's it for now. Thank you for joining us and see you next time when we bring you into the world of seeing differently.